You are listening to Microchurches, a podcast for missionaries and leaders living out their God-given calling through this small expression of the church. This podcast is meant to encourage, equip, and contribute to the overall discussion of this smaller way. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy. You are listening to Microchurches, a podcast for people brave enough to be small. This is your host, Tommy Wilkerson. And in this season, we are talking to microchurch leaders, network leaders from around the country, around the world, just trying to figure out what people are learning as they journey with microchurches and as they navigate microchurch life. And so this particular episode is special because it's a little bit different. We're not actually talking about microchurches or something that might be relevant to microchurches per se, as much as we're taking a step back and we're looking at network life and network leadership. And so one thing that all networks are going to have to face or navigate, as maybe any living thing navigates, is transition and leadership transition. And so this is actually an idea that we had flirted with as we were recording this last season, season three. And it was just kind of an offhanded comment that Lucas had made to Jeremy as we were wrapping up an episode, just things that we've learned as we have navigated leadership transitions of decentralized networks. And so this is going to be a really kind of a gift and an exciting conversation. I have a number of guests with me on this episode, and all of us sit in different positions as we talk about leadership transition. And so I'm super excited. Of course, I have Lucas Pulley joining me on this episode, as well as Josh Benedum, currently right now a part of Dwell, but is also thinking about his future and his plans for his family. And Taylor McCall is supposed to be joining us on this episode. He is not here currently, but if he joins us in the middle of this episode, you will witness like the first time that this has ever happened in Microchurch's history. And so, guys, thank you so much for being on this episode with me.
Happy to be on, and can't wait for Taylor to jump on halfway through and just jump into the middle of a conversation. It's going to be amazing.
Absolutely. We should try to give him as little orientation as possible when he jumps in.
We should immediately expect him to answer the question that we're answering without knowing what the question is.
Yeah. Just say, to the best of your understanding, just go for it.
You know what? He might actually be able to do it too. That's the crazy part.
Yeah.
We were talking about before we even hit record on this, is that to me, this situation or this conversation is an interesting one to navigate because, I think when we talk about something like mega churches and celebrity pastors, we understand the risks that are inherent in such a leadership transition, right? Like, what's Saddleback without Rick Warren? What is it Bethlehem Church? Somebody's going to at me without John Piper. Like, it's just, there's just certain people, certain churches and certain communities that we immediately associate with their leader. And when they transition out, it's like, oh man, is that thing going to sustain? Is it going to operate? But decentralized networks are different because rather than it being about a singular person, it really is about this grassroots level, everyday missionary trying to be faithful to the call of God. And whoever is the director, the executive director, centralized functioning person in that role, they're really kind of hidden behind that network of leaders. And yet, there is a sense of this apostolic leader, this person who leads the leaders, and a way that people have kind of submitted to that person's spiritual authority, that if that person moves on, I just imagine that transition being really delicate, that founder, specifically the founder to first director after the founder, being a really delicate transition. Maybe not so much it two or three transitions later, but that first transition is just a really delicate time for the organization. And so, Dwell, you guys have been around for, 60 years?
Yeah, about 55, I think. So
yeah,
headed that direction.
Yeah, so 55 years. Lucas, you wrote like a whole thesis on this. Like, this is your independent study in your seminary years and something that you've experienced too. And so, I would just be curious to just kind of maybe just lob the ball in your court from here. And I would just love to hear, what are your thoughts and what have you all learned in leadership transition, specifically of these sorts of networks?
Yeah, I mean, I think First, I'll just paint the picture of the problem, and then Josh can maybe jump in with some thoughts. But you've done a good, Tomi, a good job kind of teeing it up. But generally, the church's imagination for leadership transitions over the last 30 or 40, 50 years has a particular pattern to it. It has it has a few like shifts or exceptions or whatever. And I actually want to be really careful not to paint a straw man argument, but to like create like an honest intellectual picture of how leadership transitions typically look or function in a prevailing model church, right? So you have a pastoral leader that typically is entrusted with an enormous amount of responsibility in that community. Like they're not just sort of an upfront leader, but a lot of times they're also doing vision and staffing and management. They've got a lot of tasks. That person has a transition in their calling, whatever, they move on. Let's say it's a good thing. Let's say it's not a catastrophic moral failure. Let's say it's like they move on to a different, like called to a different ministry position. The existing church would typically start some kind of search process, maybe they put together like an elder, a committee, a search committee that has a couple of like elders on it that are sort of overseers in the community, and the responsibility of the transition goes into the hands of the elders or the overseers of that church community without that pastor. And they start looking around for potential replacements. They might look internally for replacements. They might invite people in the church to apply. But a lot of times they look externally for people to apply. And when people are applying, what are the competencies they're looking for? A lot of times they're looking for seminary degrees. They're looking for MDivs or MATs, and they're looking for the type of school that those people went to. And they're looking for those things on a resume as like a credit to them, right? That they can trust this seminary kind of built in them the competency. The other thing they're looking for is experience. They're looking for experience of like years of experience doing a similar role in a different place. And eventually they'll that committee will make an offer. They'll have them come in and preach a couple times. And the congregation is sort of like, did we like what we listened to or not? And, you know, maybe they like vote or they feel good about it. The elders have the decision. Like, so generally there's like a backbone pattern that most church, there's some fluctuations, of course, but that's the imagination, right? The church's imagination around leadership transitions are kind of captured by that pattern. Well, now we have, like over the last, especially since COVID, my goodness, like over the last 5, 10, 15 years, we just have this enormous like explosion of grassroots, decentralized, disciple making, simple church planting, multiplication, desiring kind of movements happening across or around the world. A lot of those right now, not all of them, but a lot of those over the, like in the West over the last 5 or 10 years are still like operating on their first generation of leadership. And I just think it's like a problem on the horizon that they're like, it's sort of like in the water that these decentralized movements have sort of exploded. And there is not yet a new imagination for leadership transition. And a lot of them are going to run into that transition point in the next 2 to 5, 10 years of like having to transition from that first founding or first generation team or something like that, to passing the baton to a second executive leader or a second sort of team of leaders. And the pattern that we've inherited for how we imagine leader, like pastoral leadership transition or whatever, does not work. It will not work for decentralized grassroots kind of leadership transition. It just won't. For a lot of reasons. I mean, not just to mention like the seminary degree, the competencies that you're looking for from those, like if you were to put out like a job description or something like that, the competencies that you typically be looking for don't work. Like it's a totally different set of competencies. There's not a lot of like accredited training entities that you can look at on a resume and say, oh, they've been equipped to do this. There's also not a lot of people out there with experience yet that they could point to and say, I did a similar thing over in this place or whatever. So even like how we imagine looking for candidates that would be good is we're sort of bankrupt in a little bit. And the other difficulty is how power and spiritual authority work in a prevailing entity, like a lot of that can be, you can really hold on to positional or title authority in a prevailing model kind of church entity. And then when you bring somebody in, a new in, you're just handing them the position and the title, and the community is giving them spiritual authority because the community has gotten used to relying on the title and the position as the spiritual authority. But decentralized movements don't operate that way. We don't operate with spiritual authority entangled with title and position. Spiritual authority is like a totally different thing. So the way that you're kind of bringing people in, they don't sort of have that cheat code of like, just give me a title and a chair and everybody's just going to like entrust to me spiritual authority. That's not how it works. So that makes it really complicated. So that's why I think it's a really critical question that should be on our mind. And now we can sort of talk it out for like an hour, but like, I think it is a serious problem on the horizon because like it's, and maybe people are experiencing it now, but if they're not now, they're going to. And before I'll let him ask it and maybe tease it out a little bit. But right before we started the call, Josh actually asked the question, like a pretty provocative question, like, is it even possible to do a leadership, apostolic leadership transition in a decentralized grassroots kind of movement network? Is it even possible to do it? Or is there some kind of like alternative, or you just kind of like, you're just always starting over? So I think that's just painting like it's an adaptive problem that we're all going to be starting to like, and we have ideas about that, and we have experiences about that we can kind of chop up on this episode. But I think anybody who has experience in this space has something rich, because I think like nationally and internationally, people are going to be running into this wall over the next like 5-6 years. So Josh, you want to say more?
Yeah. It's funny. I really agree with the way that you laid all that out. I actually just a year ago got my first recruiting letter from another church.
Oh, interesting.
I'd never received up until that point anything like it, but it was literally a brochure. It was from some church, non-denominational evangelical church in Annapolis, Maryland. I think that's Maryland, right? Annapolis?
Maybe. I'm very bad at geography, but let's all trust you. Let's all trust you.
We're the Naval Academy. Yeah. But it was this fold out brochure with these pictures of these beautiful East Coast scenes and lighthouses and all this different stuff, and it was this advertisement, this job advertisement saying, we want you to apply for this position of teaching pastor at this new at this church in Annapolis. And it was funny to me because, you know, I went to seminary after I was already leading in the context of a grassroots movement. I didn't go to seminary and then join up with something. I went to seminary to get some extra equipping because I was already in a leadership pastoral position. And so the idea of just being imported into something was fun. I was sitting there thinking to myself, like, what's this church's situation? Where did it come from? Why would somebody like me be needed? What happened to the old guy? You know, like all those sorts of questions. And just feeling somewhat relieved that's not how I came into my current role. It was in that way, but I was raised up organically into what it is that I'm currently doing. The prevailing model of leadership transition, this is all the sorts of things that I think microchurch and house church network type people know and agree with, but it's corporate, right? It's got its roots in more of almost the CEO type business world. It's the professionalization of ministry. It's that ethic is just, it's kind of obvious that's how the prevailing model transition would happen, because that institutional corporate model is what is really in many ways co-opted the church for the last however many years of Western history. So in many ways it's not surprising, but it's also cool and refreshing that we get to be a part of something new, something which I believe could be more organic, but also more New Testament than what the prevailing model has found its way into. So, yeah, as far as how this all looks, and And what are the things that we should be thinking about? I love the fact that this is uncharted territory, because I think that people are going to have to do new thinking on it. New thinking, new praying, sharing of experiences. I hope this podcast can be a meaningful contribution to that as networks try to figure it out. There are a few things I think from my own experience that I can say with some degree of certainty is going to matter for any group that's trying to do something like this. I think that it has to be. So I posed that question at the beginning of our call. Is it even possible to have a true leadership transition, or are movements always going to have to sort of be restarted? Can you really replace the apostolic leader or not? And my honest sense on that is I don't know if you can import a leader. I feel somewhat agnostic on that. I'll say that I've never seen it work.
Yeah.
To import a leader from outside the organization to take something over. And I think the reason for that is exactly one of the reasons that you just gave. It has to do with like how is spiritual authority conferred in a network. Mm-hmm. And it's not just something you can import someone into a position and say, hey, this is our new executive director. They're now in charge of the apostolic vision of this church. Like it's because in many ways, the spiritual authority that person has to do with what they've built. Right.
Yeah.
And how the Lord has borne fruit through them as they've built relational networks and discipled and taught. And all of that has gradually accumulated. And so the idea of bringing someone in to just sort of like take up that mantle, it all just falls to pieces around them, because it wasn't ever built through some sort of authority structure. It was built through this much more natural process of actual relationships. So I think my sense on this is that if it is possible to accomplish a leadership transition like what we're talking about, I feel like 9 times out of 10, it's going to have to be a homegrown leader. It's going to have to be someone else who's come up within that network in the same way, gradually doing these things and building these sorts of connections, cultivated, maybe trained externally in some ways, but ultimately that comes up with the DNA and the ethos of the movement. It's really hard for me to imagine it happening another way.
Yeah.
Which is perhaps what makes this conversation so interesting, is because, yeah, I mean, right before we were talking, we were saying that, you know, Dwell, your community in particular, you've never done outside leaders, even in terms of house church leaders, like everything from the, I guess, lowest leadership level to the highest leadership level, executive leadership. It's like all ingrown, or not ingrown, homegrown. Ingrown is something else entirely, but homegrown. And then, yeah, for Lucas, I mean, your experience was you were leading the Carbondale Underground when you came to Tampa. So it wasn't that you were entirely imported, like you were a part of, I don't know, another community out in San Francisco that had like nothing hybrid to do with the Underground. It's like you're a sister movement, but you weren't necessarily local to Tampa. And so you experienced that, like, I'm imported, sort of, and having to like navigate that leadership transition. And so,
very, very complicated.
Yeah, I'd love to hear Lucas talk about that, because my experience is coming up from within the movement and then being asked to take on leadership, oversight in a context where I'd been there, you know, from the time that I started walking with the Lord up until that moment. So
yeah, I mean, very complicated, because like we would say, these kind of decentralized grassroots network movements, you know, the saying is, we're not organizational, we're relational. You know, the Underground is not an organization, it's a network of relationships. And because we are fundamentally relational, that's why like the way that we kind of discern or respond to or elevate spiritual authority is sort of a relational enterprise, right? It's like you your spiritual authority, your respect in the community, your gravitas in the community is sort of built over time by how you live your life and how people witness it, and your integrity and character that people get to oversee. Like you said, Josh, it's like a little bit what you built. It's what you've led. It's how you've lived. And yeah, it's very complicated. I mean, the Tampa movement knew me enough, knew my name, knew a little bit about what I was up to in Illinois, interacted with my public forms of leadership on a few different occasions. But it was it felt very much like an import. And what that did the way that affected me is, like, I feel like if you were sort of like homegrown leader and you've already got quite a, you know, but in the words of Bobby Clinton, leadership isn't something that we strive to or generate, but like God, it's leadership emergence is a thing that God does and a community witnesses and confirms, mm-hmm. you know, so lessons. That, yeah, totally. So for me, it was sort of like, coming into a place, and I think if I was a homegrown leader, I would have functioned apostolically quicker. I would have felt a lot of room to run and dream and innovate and have vision. And I would have operated with the confidence that the community's down to run with me and happy for me to run that way. But coming in from the outside, it did feel very much like for the first couple years, I really needed to come in underneath and sort of be a servant and not shake up too much. And there was a lot this was the thing about Tampa Underground. There was a lot of existing apostolic leadership. I just needed to make room for the existing apostolic leadership. I didn't need to necessarily function that way and sort of coordinate the existing apostolic leadership, platform the existing apostolic leadership. But I felt like I needed to put the time in for a couple years, and build, and to where it felt like by the time, to a few years later, 2017, 2018, it sort of felt like I was stepping into the job for the first time as a homegrown leader. Do you know what I'm saying? I came in from the outside in and functioned a certain way. And around 2018, I sort of internally had a shift where I started functioning in the same role, but functioning a different way because I felt like the room was giving me that spiritual authority. And it was very obvious. And by the room, the movement, right? The community was happy for me to run that way. And it felt like I sort of shifted. Part of the reason, I don't know if this would work every way, but really briefly, part of the way I think that worked, I don't know if it would work everywhere, but part of the reason that worked is because of how the underground is set up a little bit. Cause I think, again, when we're saying, we keep saying leadership transition, but we could mean very different things, right?
Right.
A microchurch leader transition is one thing, a microchurch. And we could talk about that in a little bit. What's that like? What are the options? How does that look? But then there's leader of leaders of a movement, what we call governing elders, but overseers, not just of a microchurch, but over a collective of microchurches, a network of microchurches, and sort of overseeing the vision of the broader community and the direction and maybe even character or moral failures, that kind of stuff. So that requires an enormous amount of spiritual authority. And there's those kinds of leadership transitions. And then there's the staff, the executive director, the staff environment, those kind of leaders who exist to serve and provide equipping and those kinds of environments and resources and stuff for the churches. That's how we're set up, where the governance structure is separated from the service platform. And so that sort of helped me where I could actually come in as an executive director and I was not a governing elder. Those two things they often in our history have overlapped, but they don't have to, the way that we're sort of set up. So I could come in as an executive director and I'm just serving the network. I'm a deacon. I'm setting up, I'm just trying to serve the network of churches, whatever they need. And it doesn't implicitly have to have visionary leadership and spiritual authority, because like that's technically like the role and realm of the governing elders. So I actually wasn't a governing elder for the first like probably year and a half. I am now. Yeah. And even, and it was even good to have a season where it's like, I just needed to lead a microchurch here. Like I needed to be a practitioner. I needed to like prove myself as like an equal and like one of, and just as committed and willing to bleed for the lost and the poor in my city. And over time, let the community like watch my character, that kind of stuff. And then eventually, like, again, it was after like about a year and a half, I was like, I was already ordained as like an elder of another community in Illinois, but this community like ordained me while I was the executive director, like running the programs. And there was like a Sunday morning where they ordained me after like a year and a half. And then invited me to come on the governing elders and that kind of thing. So again, if it sort of helped me that those things were separated, and it made sense to be able to bring in an outside, like import an outside leader, because they're really just taking a job to serve and like provide that, like those kinds of things. Again, there's other communities that those things overlap a lot more. And that's not good or bad. Like we're set up, it's contextualization, right? Like we're set up in a way that makes sense for what we do and where we're at. And there's other communities that overlaps a lot more. The governing elders are also sort of functioning as a staff team and a board of directors and that kind of thing. Again, very difficult to bring in an outsider in that kind of a situation for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned, Josh.
Totally.
But yeah, that was briefly sort of the complexity of my story. Like I basically just came in and spent an enormous amount of time just getting to know, like leading a microchurch, getting to know people, like providing all the services, like serving everyone as much as possible, letting them kind of observe and get to know me as much as they want, and operating in my gifts in every way that felt like wise, like not trying to hold back too much, because that's another extreme that is bad. Like if you hold back who you are too much, you know, there's a little bit of a tension there. And then letting the community entrust to me spiritual authority over time, instead of me relying on a title and just running with it, you know. And I think, Tomi, you could speak to it too. But I kind of watched you walk a similar journey, like when you came to Tampa, like, kind of step in. I mean, you weren't like the executive director when you first came. You were like in the service department, that kind of stuff. But get here, lead a like, weren't immediately a governing elder, like start leading a microchurch, start being a servant. You were a part of the service platform, like, and over time, like after a couple years, start like the community starts entrusting spiritual authority. Now you're a governing elder. Now you're like more a part of like functioning apostolically, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for Josh and for your community, I mean, yeah, I'd be curious, I mean, to hear your thoughts, but I mean, as we're talking about these two very different experiences of homegrown leadership and then maybe imported leadership or kind of like a hybrid, if Taylor were here, he'd have, you know, something else to contribute in his experience of leadership transition and his thoughts. But as you guys are talking about it, I guess I'm just curious, like, is there, like, what are the pros and cons of each of those? Like, so to say, like, yeah, there's something beautiful about being homegrown, but then I could also see conflicts in that, right? Depending on the nature of the community. And maybe it's because Dwell has always been homegrown that it's not a problem. But I could see, like, I'm going to totally butcher your book, J.R. Woodward, if you're listening to this. I'm so sorry. But you're, like, literally one of the smartest people I've ever met. And he was talking about, like, mimetic desire and leadership and the way that, like, we see leaders and we aspire to be that person. And if so, there's a way that, like, if you have a community of leaders who are all really high level and then the executive leader steps out, then it's almost like a wrestling match. Like, who's the next one in charge? And you guys have done that. You've done, like, the leadership transition from your original two founders to another two leaders. And so, I don't know, I'd just be curious to hear your experiences. And then, yeah, maybe if there is a conversation about pros and cons of homegrown versus imported, yeah, we can get into that too.
Yeah. I love, it was really cool hearing Lucas's story. I think, honestly, it seems to me like if you're going to import, that's what it would need to look like. Is exactly what Lucas just described.
Stick around long enough to where it's almost homegrown.
Well,
to where it feels like it's homegrown. Yeah.
I don't know if this was by design, but the fact that you were hired into a position, but there was still sort of like something else, like you were hired into a leadership position. There's two things that stick out to me about your experience. One is that you weren't coming from just a prevailing model church. You were coming from something that had, like, I don't know if what you're describing would have worked out if you'd just been coming from some mega church.
Totally.
You know? And so you had enough of the ethos, you had enough of the like-mindedness to like establish some baseline of trust that you could function in that role. And so I think the fact that you had that, but then also the fact that you had some time before you were made a governing elder to sort of develop and build that sort of relational capital and grow a natural spiritual authority. I think that's probably in big part why that was successful, you know? So those two things just stick out to me about your story. But yeah, so with Dwell, I realize I should probably amend the statement. It's not that we don't ever have people who are leaders come in from the outside. But it's more so that, like, one difference between the way we would normally do things, I think, or have done things in the past. We're pretty flexible in terms of what we think about the future, but we would not hire someone into a staff leadership role until they had sort of had the opportunity to build ministry and to kind of grow and function within like more of like a home church, like a non-staff home church leader role. And so we've had people like one guy who served as a governing elder for us for a long time is Scott Arnold, who, he was our, the Central Ohio Director for Youth for Christ. And he came to Columbus originally to establish a Youth for Christ chapter in Columbus, and then joined our church. And even though he was a very developed leader on an executive level, he just led a home church and was organically just, you know, personally involved with people, you know, making disciples, just doing that sort of thing. And then eventually was recognized and brought into staff positions and then, filled a governing elder role for a time. And so we do have examples of that, but we would just, I don't think we would typically bring someone in into like any kind of like upper leadership role unless they had been a part of like the baseline of our movement, you know? Yeah, I think it is complicated. I imagine it's more complicated for a really large church. Probably one of the most interesting things about Dwell, and I think me and Tomi are going to talk with Matt Ulrich about this in a future podcast, is that as far as I know, we are like one of the largest, if not the largest, like mega church that is also a house church movement. And so that does create some interesting dynamics in terms of how we're organized and also what a leadership transition should look like. I think for the smaller network, it might be a little bit different. But a few things that I can say about my experience is, and this is something which our founding elders really get a lot of credit for this, because you're right. One of the awesome strengths about this sort of leadership setup and more of a flat structure is that, you know, I led house churches for, you know, 15 years. And there was probably people who would be involved in my house church. They were, you know, being discipled, they were sharing their faith, growing, finding all these ways to serve God. They met Christ in our house church, who did not even know any of our founders' names for probably 5 years. You know, 4 or 5 years. And so, and that's partially because their entire experience of our community was more located within the ecosystem of their house church and like the relationships that they formed. And so we don't have people we're putting up as celebrities in front of the whole church and stuff. And so on one hand, that makes for a very natural transition because people have they associate leadership and authority and even spiritual influence with the people that they're connected to. Like it's not necessarily it's not always strongly associated with like our teaching pastors or people like that. It's more so with the people that lead their house churches or maybe the coach or the person who sort of oversees that network of house churches or micro churches. And so on one hand, that really sets you up for a transition like this because we bring people up a variety, like a large, what we often call like a deep bench, deep bench of people who are really qualified to lead in these high level pastoral roles, to govern the church and to with maturity and wisdom and biblical character to oversee the life of the church. And they're already doing that usually on a smaller scale by overseeing a network of house churches or micro churches that they've planted. And that was my situation. My wife and I planted, we grew and planted our house church a bunch of times. We had discipled people that were then working in and leading and multiplying other house churches. And so we had this organic family of groups in which we had influence. And as that was recognized and as I was trained, et cetera, I slowly was given more responsibility to oversee larger groups of people, to have more of like a formal teaching role in some cases and things like that. And so in many ways, there was no like radical shift for me. Like nothing happened fast. Mm-hmm. Neither for me nor for the church. And that's also true for the rest of our current board of elders. We're an elder-led church. We do have two senior elders who fill sort of like a point leadership role for the elder team, but they don't have any special authority other than I think like a tiebreaker vote in the elders meetings.
Yeah.
And so we have a flat structure. We currently have 10 elders in our church that kind of govern the entirety of the church and then delegate oversight authority to pastors who we call sphere leaders. And so most of our elders are also sphere leaders. In the sense that they directly pastor a network of house churches or micro churches. But then have this additional governing role for the entirety of the church. And so that's my job. That's part of what I do now. But you're right though, your point that it could lead to a competitive dynamic or maybe even a sort of like provincialism is actually pretty insightful. That actually has been a long-term struggle in our church is that people sometimes have a certain loyalty to like kind of the network of people that they're involved with. And it's difficult for us at times to maintain cohesion and cooperation because there's not that centralized sense of like, you know, who is the apostolic leader here? Who's kind of responsible for the vision? Because people often feel like that's more like, that's the person that I'm associated with. And so it can become
right.
Sort of this, and maybe I even take a little bit of comfort in this, knowing that this was a problem in the early church too, but it's the I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos.
Type of
dynamic. And so we've had to fight that pretty intentionally. So one way that this has played out for us, and this is where our founding elders, I think, get so much credit, is they probably started prepping this transition. Not probably, they've said this. They began actively putting weekly time into preparing and shaping this transition over 15 years ago. So they formally all transitioned out of leadership, three and a half, 4 years ago. And they began to slowly onboard the people that they believed could take over a lot of their roles. Not over the course of a year, not over the course of 2 years, but over the course of the better part of 15 years. And began to develop those people. Both of our senior elders at the time met like one-on-one with people that they were kind of vetting and developing to take over some of these roles, and and gave them meaningful responsibilities in different parts of the church to both build influence and to demonstrate that the Lord was behind them in these different capacities. And so in a lot of ways, by the time the handoff was completed, it's almost like it wasn't that jarring, I think, for anyone, because a lot of us had kind of, we'd been there the whole time. We'd been yeah. coming up, and they'd been putting us forward to, you know, when the church would gather on a larger level, they'd when we get all the house churches together, we'd have what we call central teachings, which is the equivalent of your guys' hub meetings. We would, they would have us kind of up front, you know, teaching, communicating, you know, like writing, you know, just doing a lot more of the things that, that does add some element of centralization to our network. And so I think the thoroughness of that process, I mean, it definitely was a matter of great wisdom and foresight, I think, for them that they did that. But I also think that there's an element where it was in the DNA of the movement to do that. Mm. And I think that's another important thing for maybe burgeoning movements to understand, is like the kind of DNA ethos, whatever word you want to use, that you're currently putting into your movement for how you multiply and replace people on like the house church or the micro church level, that some of those same principles should animate the way that you do things on the top level too. I don't think it's exactly the yeah. same, but things like, I don't know, like one thing that I really believe in is plurality of leadership. Right. And I think that, so believing in a plurality of leadership and being committed to more of a flat leadership structure, that's going to, if you believe in that, and if you think that holds true for the top as well as the bottom, then it's going to animate the way that you go about that process. And so I think, while it is true that movements typically have one, maybe two, like apostolic leaders who often lay sort of a philosophical foundation and create the initial momentum that builds out in a true movement that's focused on multiplying lay leadership, ideally that apostolic leader is still going to build like, they're going to build a mechanism around them that does enable that true plurality of leadership, that flatter structure where even they are accountable. And then if that's been built, then I think onboarding people gradually into that who can eventually take over should be a fairly natural process, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. What do you guys think about that? I mean, I think that's been our experience on some level. But I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I mean, yeah, I mean, a 15-year vision of your own transition. I mean, in general, that demonstrates intentionality behind your transition, right? So, I mean, the reality is that leadership transitions will happen or can happen, I guess, one of two ways. They can happen either intentionally or unintentionally, right? So the stuff can happen, moral failure happens or whatever, or somebody just drops everything and decides they're gonna go start something else. And that's like, somebody gets thrust in and it's not really a delicate transition. It's just, here you are. But if it's like a thought out transition, then there is something beautiful in like putting the necessary people in place. And in both those cases, both Lucas, this imported person, and Josh, the one that's a little bit more homegrown, there is a way that it is a delicate transition, a long transition of like gradually moving into a position where people can kind of see your life and grow into, I don't know, recognizing your spiritual authority and saying, yes, I echo this and I'm 100% behind this. And it's beautiful. And it sounds like even if there is some sort of imported leader, it sounds like, yeah, just maybe it has to get to a place where that person can almost function as a homegrown leader, almost like this engrafted branch. Mm-hmm. It takes a while for an engrafted branch to really catch to the, you know, the natural plant. But once it does, then right. It can begin bearing fruit. But it just takes a while to actually attach, you know, which maybe gets us into that question, or maybe it answers a question that it doesn't actually matter. But that question of pros and cons, like, is there, what are the pros and cons of somebody imported versus somebody homegrown? And I mean, we're just scratching the surface here. And so this might have to be a few episodes, or maybe at least another episode, talking into some of the other the questions. But maybe we'll end on that, like pros and cons of imported versus homegrown leader for something like such as this.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to. I don't mean to hijack your episode here, Tomi, but I'd love to do that pros and cons thing when Taylor is, if we can schedule another time with Taylor, because I think Josh and I can sort of like guess what the pro, like Josh and I are both biased toward homegrown, and so we could sort of guess the pros and cons to like importing from the outside. But just knowing Taylor, I do think Taylor has some thoughts around actually it maybe being better or more ideal to import leaders from the outside, and I've never been able to talk to him about why. So I'd love to hear his thoughts about why. But but maybe I'll just add two last quick thoughts for me, like meta, like broad scale thoughts, and if Josh has a last couple things before we close up the episode. But two things really quick. We have another kind of grassroots network of Simple Church, you know, disciple makers and Simple Churches in Tampa that we're friends with. And they just had their like primary apostolic leader, founder guy, like he just moved in January. And so we're friends with them, and Tomi and I have been talking with some of the leaders from their team. And I was really interested that we were asking them, like last time I saw one of their leaders, I was like, "Hey, how's the movement going and how's the transition stuff going?" And asked them like what their plans are. And he just said, "You know, I don't think we're going to do anything." And I just think it's an interesting option on the table that when you have plurality of leadership, which all these kind of decentralized movements usually do, like this apest plurality, a deep bench, you know, in Josh's words, like a lot of leaders, there's also this option that you don't actually have to replace that leader.
It's true.
Like it's an actual option on the table, which again, in a lot of prevailing model kind of church paradigms would often never be an option. Mm-hmm. You absolutely have, it's a baseline assumption. You absolutely have to replace that leader. But, they've kind of discerned that like for now they don't actually need to replace that leader, and they've had some interesting reasons why. I mean, one of the things that I thought had a lot of wisdom in it was that apostolic leader that they had was what is so off the charts apostolic that the broader movement has for many years sort of been drafting off of that energy.
Yeah.
Which is good. It's a great thing. Like it's a gift to the church. But what can happen is that people over time can like not actually don't feel the responsibility to take ownership for apostolic. Like there might actually be other apostolic leaders in the room, but they don't actually feel the need to step into that because that apostolic leader is driving so hard. So it's not that they're saying, hey, there doesn't need to be apostolic leadership here at all, because they do have some, but almost like the way that those fivefold gifts are mixing, like they're never perfectly like operating on all, you're always sort of in a mix. There's always one that's sort of in the season of the movement. There's always one that's maybe sort of you're leaning into a little bit more than others. And they've just decided in this season, it's not that they're not apostolic, they are, but they're letting some of these other gifts take prominence for a quick season. And some of that too is just organizational dynamics. It's like it's sort of growing and pruning. It's like you always have like a drive to like start 100 things, and then there needs to be a season where you deepen the 50 out of those 100 things that you started that actually can sustain.
Totally.
And you trim and let half of those things kind of like die off or whatever. And then after you've kind of deepened and you're healthy and you're rooted, then it's like, all right, let's go crazy again. Like let's start another 100 things or something. So there's also that kind of seasonal shift that the type of leadership that your movement needs sort of fluctuates over time, as you're sort of like analyzing the movement.
Yeah, no, I'd love to hear you talk more about that sometime, because I think that's right on. I think that that's like an entire other chapter. If this podcast was that'd be a whole other chapter of like, well, what about just not replacing that leader? What about for a different season. And I'm a big believer in that. I think that movements and institutions do go through seasons. And I think that things can and should look different at different times while attempting to maintain some of the core things of what make you who you are. So I agree with that. And I think one alternative to that, and this is something which I think when apostolic leaders can do this, I think it's cool, is for them to try to create spaces for other apostolic leaders to function and maybe develop so that they don't have to be totally removed in order for people to start filling that space and expressing those gifts.
Yeah.
And again, I think that could look different for different movements, but
sure.
I guess like one final thing that I'll say, one of the guys who mentored me, who was one of our founders and one of the elders that passed the torch onto us, he would just very rawly say all the time, and I heard him say it over and over again in different settings. He'd be like, yeah, I mean, I could get hit by a bus or have an affair. And he would just repeat that like over and over again, you know, and you could tell that it was just on his mind that like he needed to replace himself. And that wasn't something he started thinking about when he turned 60 or when, you know, it was something that he was thinking about the whole time, is that like, I'm supposed to be raising up other people and working myself out of a job. That's true on the house church, micro church level. It's true. It's like multiplication, like involves the idea that I'm going to have to replace myself. Right. And that I'm not just trying to fill a space and keep that space filled until I die, you know, but I'm trying to raise people up, minimally to do what I'm doing somewhere else, if not doing exactly what I'm doing. And I think when leaders think that way, not just when transition seasons approach, but when they think that way as like, I'm not indispensable and I can't be indispensable to this movement. It's like only God and the Holy Spirit is indispensable to this movement. And a big part of my job in line with Ephesians 4 is to equip the saints, right? It's to develop other people up and to be able to do these things. And so I just feel like that mindset for a leader, matters at every level, no matter what level you're leading on.
So good.
Well, Josh, I know you gotta make like a banana and split, so I want to like release you. Thank you so much for spending, you know, some of your time with us today. And yeah, like we kind of got into, we're just scratching the tip of the surface. We're like at the very tip of the iceberg. There's so many things underneath this. I have questions that we just haven't even touched on in this episode. So there will definitely be a part two. We'll see where that takes us, if we need a part three. But this has been Micro Churches. Thank you guys so much for listening. Hopefully this conversation has been a blessing to you and has stirred your thinking about networks and leadership and all sorts of things. And so until next time.